You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, myself, and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today we are talking again about real-world evidence and the viewpoint of the FDA on it. So if you haven't listened to the part one of this two-part series, then just scroll back in your player a little bit and look for the other episode. I'm speaking with Joseph Wolfram today again, so stay tuned for a really, really nice episode. If you're interested in real-world evidence, there is a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of webinars on the PSI homepage that you can have a look into, and there is also the special interest group. The special interest group on real-world data that is led by Annie Starry is really, really new, but it's also really active already. And so there's a lot of things going on there. If you're interested in this special interest group or any other special interest group, just head over to the PSI homepage. PSI is a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. And you can join this community too. It is only £20 for non-high income countries and only £95 for high income countries. Per year, of course. So head over to psiweb.org to learn about this and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. And today it's again with Josie. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Very good. It's awesome to talk again. This is the second part of the interview with Josie about real-world data and real-world evidence. And if you haven't checked the first one, then scroll back in your podcast player and look for the other episode, and then maybe listen to this one first. In that episode, we talked about the FDA's perspective on real-world data and real-world evidence, and also how that might be a bit different from other aspects. And we talked about reliability and relevance. And we also talked quite a lot about exposure, because that is so important, and how you can ascertain it, how you can validate it. And from there, I want to go into the second part of this podcast episode and talk a little bit about the outcome ascertainment and validation. So what are the critical pieces we need to think about ascertainment of outcomes there?
Before I jump into answering, I probably should share my disclaimer a second time, right?
Okay. Yeah, let's just be on the legal safe side. Yeah.
Right. So just, you know, to say the opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of myself and not necessarily those of my employer, Astellas. And Astellas does not guarantee the accuracy or reliability of the information provided herein. So coming back to outcome ascertainment and validation. So what FDA, you know, describe when they talk about outcome ascertainment and validation is that first what you need to do is to generate what they term a conceptual definition for your outcome. And this needs to be a definition that can be operationalized in real world data sources. So to take a sort of very typical example in oncology, the clinical endpoint in trials would tend to be tumor progression based on RECIST. But that's not something that's typically captured. So you need to develop an operational, firstly, a conceptual definition of something that you will be able to operationalize in your data source. For example, time to next treatment might be an alternative way to proxy for tumor progression. And then you need an operational definition using diagnosis and procedure codes, such as ICD-10 codes or SNOMED codes or laboratory test codes that you can use to define your outcome. And yeah, this can be using, you know, coding systems that are part of the structured data. You may also try to extract from the unstructured data, so from physicians' encounter notes or radiology and pathology reports, to, you know, to really curate the endpoint you're looking for.
Let's double click on this a little bit. So in terms of concept, is this concept always kind of coming from the clinical trial thinking, or could it also come more from other aspects, kind of, you know, the physician or patient perspective on things?
It needs to be an outcome that is being captured as part of routine care.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you will have that physician's or patient's perspective on that, mm-hmm. since it's what is being, you know, monitored in routine care. And that's not the case with many of the clinical trial endpoints that we might use. So normally when you go to the doctor, you're not issued a 25-page patient-reported outcome to fill in.
Yeah. And also the physician doesn't fill in such a questionnaire himself. Yeah. So I think that's an important point to have a look into. Yeah. So even though you may not have the same kind of things as in clinical trials, that's not necessarily kind of a limitation. Yeah. So the nice thing is you have something that is actually done, actually measured. Yeah. And so you don't necessarily always need to come from a clinical trial perspective and then search for something that you can do on the real world data. You can also come from the real world data perspective and see kind of what is possible there from a consent perspective and what is meaningful for physicians and patients. And of course, a change in therapy, yeah, most likely means something didn't work well. Yeah, unless it's kind of, oh, you're changing from an oncology therapy now to, or just, you know, treating the, I don't know, the blood pressure or something like this because your tumor has gone away. Yeah, but if you kind of add another kind of oncology treatment or kind of increase a dose or whatsoever, that's usually a bad thing. And so that may be something that is much more kind of drastically something that has an impact, then maybe there's a couple of the other things that you would measure, kind of some lab changes or whatsoever, so that doesn't directly have a clinical relevance in that way.
Right. And, you know, real world data will perhaps lend itself better to the sort of harder types of outcomes.
Yeah.
Than perhaps the sort of softer types of outcomes. Yeah.
Yeah. And very often you have larger sample sizes, so that makes it possible then also to still see something. Yeah, you know, very often we have these more specific outcomes in clinical trials because we have the smaller sample size, and we need to see something, you know, much more kind of fine tuned than in this real world data where we maybe have tens of thousands of patients. Yeah.
That's right. And if you think of, say, cardiovascular outcomes, MACE, endpoints like this that can be very challenging to study in a clinical trial, that kind of endpoint can be operationalized pretty well in the real-world data setting.
Yeah, very good. So that is about ascertainment. What about validation?
Yes, so validation is then the exercise of confirming that the operational definition that you used to extract the outcome from your data source has correctly captured the concept that you defined for your outcome. And FDA expects validation of the outcome variable to minimize outcome misclassification. And they state, and here I quote, that ideally, through complete verification of the outcome variable, each subject is assigned an accurate value of the outcome variable to minimize outcome misclassification and improve study internal validity. Mm-hmm. In practice, a more commonly used approach is to assess the performance of an operational definition in validation studies. So that means using a sample of patients and comparing your classification of the outcome to the original records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what is there probably then also important is understand, are there any factors that would drive misclassification? Yeah. So is there, for example, when you want to compare treatments, hopefully treatment is not a factor that drives misclassification. Yeah. You want to understand what is a bias that you see. Yeah. And in which direction does it go? Generally, misclassification, when it's not driven by any factors, more hides things. So it's probably something that you know, more has an impact on shrinking treatment effects and things like this. Only when there's a variable that is, so to say, influencing and confounds with treatment, then you can have the opposite effect. So these sub-studies are really, really interesting things. How would such a sub-study look like?
Well, you may go through an exercise of, if the data source supports it, actually going back to the original, you know, patient medical record and then comparing what you find there versus what you've derived. So perhaps if your study is conducted with claims data, you're able to link that for a certain number of patients with the EMR and compare what you find in the two sources.
That's a good way. It's kind of like with any other diagnostic tool. You need to find some kind of gold standard that you can compare against. And that gold standard needs to be, you know, good enough so that you can know that you really find misdiagnosis, miscategorization. That's really important.
And then, you know, your next step would be to look at things like the sensitivity, the specificity, or the positive predictive value, negative predictive value. And, you know, they have a sort of a discussion about which of those statistics you would be sort of aiming to assess in your validation study according to whether perhaps you're looking at a rare outcome or a more frequent outcome, etc. So,
yeah. So refresh your knowledge about diagnostic statistics.
Right.
quite a lot.
With COVID, we've all been refreshing our minds.
For sure. Probably everybody was questioned about kind of sensitivity and specificity and then positive and negative predictive values of COVID tests. Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Very good. There's one other really important thing that I wanted to touch base in this second part of the episode, of the podcast episode, and that's pre-specification. What's the FDA's approach on pre-specification with this real-world data?
Pre-specification is a strong theme that's come through in their draft guidances. You know, pre-specification in the clinical trial setting, I think we all understand what that means, because before you actually collect your data, you say what you're going to do with your data at the end, or at a minimum, you have a very specified plan, you know, before you unblind. But how can we really pre-specify a study using data that's actually already been collected?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same principles. What they want to avoid is that researchers have been in the data and actually know the answer to their research questions before declaring what their objectives and methods are. So here, pre-specification means, you know, in advance of conducting the analyses. And this is important to avoid cherry-picking results. Issues I think a statistical audience is very familiar with, but how are we going to make sure this happens? So it's a little bit harder to really demonstrate pre-specification in the situation where that data is sort of already existing. But FDA do sort of have a couple of key recommendations around that to help, reassure them that what you're doing really is pre-specified, and so that you have a kind of trail to demonstrate that.
Yeah, I think this is really, really hard. It's really hard because imagine you work on a new treatment. Yeah. And there's multiple treatments in the same class that are all developed. Yeah. So probably you are not the only one looking into this data, because all the other companies also have the same thing. Yeah. You're going to a CRO, yeah, that has access to this data and uses this data. They might have just done more or less the exact same stuff for another sponsor. Yeah. So having this pre-specified is really, really tricky. Yeah. Because you can never really 100% be sure that people haven't seen the data before. The other thing is, I think you need to have a certain level of expertise on the data to actually conduct the analysis and pre-specify the analysis. Yeah. So you need to have some kind of knowledge about the data, about the database, the structure of the database, how many patients are in there. You usually do some kind of feasibility studies before you actually do all these analysis. So through that, you'll always, you know, dip your toe into the water already. Yeah. And so you'll be kind of, you know, I think it's really hard to come with this pre-specification. However, I think pre-specification is, for me, one way to address this problem of cherry picking. Yeah. And so, and I think it's just one way. Yeah. The other way of assessing cherry picking is looking more into how robust are your analysis. Yeah. If you change a little bit here and there, yeah, your assumptions, does that make a big impact? Yeah. If you think about, let's say, your outcome concept, yeah, if you change things in there, does it dramatically change the analysis? If you think about your exposure, if you change something in there, does it dramatically impact the analysis? Yeah. Are the effects that you see really big? Yeah. Or are they kind of just kind of detectable? Yeah. If they're really big, yeah, then probably, you know, no matter what you change, they will still be rather big. Yeah. But if you need to do a lot of fine tuning here and there in your parameters, I'm not sure pre-specification will save you. and say, well, we have pre-specified all these kind of 25 different definitions. And only with this combination of all these definitions, we get to p-value of 0.45. If we change anything, you know, we don't see anything anymore. What's your point on that?
Yeah, you raised lots of great and really interesting points there. So picking up on the, you know, you can't really not look at all at your data source before you commit to using it for your study. Yes, you're right. You need to do some kind of study feasibility. How are you going to know that you have enough patients to meet your study objectives if you haven't at least queried the data sufficiently to know how many patients have your disease under study? So, you know, the guidelines do distinguish between data access for purposes of checking for study feasibility versus purposes of the actual analysis to support study objectives. I think the golden rule is, you know, don't look at outcomes by exposure group during the feasibility. And they actually suggest that in your study protocol, you should describe all the data sources that you accessed when designing the study and the results of the feasibility evaluations on these sources, and then describe, you know, your justification for which sources you use for the study. So that's, you know, quite a piece of work actually to have that nicely laid out, I guess. But that's, I suppose, a way of...
You need to be really transparent with what you do. I think that is really important.
Yeah. Transparency is, yeah, that's a key word. And then you talked about sensitivity analyses, basically. And I think that's also another key way of making your results reliable, should we say. So if it's pre-specified, it's more convincing. If your results are robust to a series of ideally also pre-specified sensitivity analyses, that I think is also going to be strongly supportive of the conclusions. And, you know, as you said, the size of the effect is important in terms of feeling of a study being able to sort of support decision making. And there are methods where you can sort of look at how much bias would there need to be to take away my effect. So like a sort of e-value. It's a bit like a tipping point type analysis.
Yeah, I really like this kind of tipping point analysis. Yeah, to say how much would we kind of need to torture the data, so to say, to skip, you know, get to a completely different outcome, and then assess, is it realistic that, you know, the data is that wrong? And if that is kind of pretty unrealistic, yeah, then I think you have a really, really good claim for your data. Awesome. Very good. So these were two outstanding episodes about real-world data, real-world evidence, what the FDA thinks about it, and what you can do to run a really, really good real-world evidence study. Josie, any final thoughts from you that helps us, the readers, in terms of working with this guideline? And by the way, we'll put lots of references on all of these on into the show notes. So any final points in terms of FDA and real-world evidence, your thoughts on that?
Actually, we were just talking about pre-specification and transparency. Perhaps one piece I didn't mention there is they are asking for sponsors to publicly post their protocols in advance. So I think that's also a best practice that, yeah, may become more of a standard, should we say, so on clintrials.gov, etc. Any last thoughts? Well, I guess maybe just to mention that, you know, we talked mostly about, you know, using electronic health records and medical claims data to support regulatory decision making. There's also a guidance document about using registries, which has very similar themes. And, you know, they talk both about designing a registry and reusing data from existing registries. So these can be a really, you know, great and rich source for real world data studies. And yeah, I think we can expect more guidance coming in the future around statistical design aspects. So I'm quite excited to see what comes through on that.
Yeah, it's definitely an area where there's a lot of things going on. And if you are still kind of, you know, thinking about what are kind of opportunities for your career, moving into real-world data is actually quite fascinating area. The amount of data is only going to increase. The real-world data use is only going to increase. And also from a statistical point of view, as you just seen, you know, there's lots of challenges that need to be addressed. And so working with data in this field, for me, is actually quite a lot of fun. So if you like that, dip into it. Yeah. And if you want to engage with the real-world data sync, then also connect with Josie on the or with Annie via the PSI homepage at psiweb.org, where you can find the special interest groups, and then just go to the real-world data sync. Thanks so much, Josie, for these two outstanding podcast episodes. All the best for you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and Casey, who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to psiweb.org to learn more about these kind of things and reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.